state to do the same thing without paying that high interest, perhaps no interest at all. And so there are these two bills that are in the legislature right now, and I think they should be supported. They are very important. Trying to think who are the legislators involved. Well, you could call your own state senator, your state representative, and tell that person to support whatever bill is appropriate, with the Senate Bill 339 or House Bill 2743. This would save the taxpayer a lot of money, and it would allow the good things to happen that government can do. And so these are worth your support. So check it out. You can go online and see where these bills are right now in the state house. So we've been talking for the most part about how much power Vladimir Putin really has, and the consensus here lists that he does not have as much power as we think he has. The best thing to do as far as helping Russia move towards democracy, I think, is to leave them alone. I think Russians are capable of getting a democracy on their own. They do not need our troops on their border. We do not need the U.S. Stirring things up in countries on the southern border. So that is that has been Fight the Empire for today. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for KBOO, your radio station.
With light supervisory duties, our ideal candidate has at least 4 years of proven development experience in the nonprofit sector, preferably with significant foundation and major donor fundraising work. For a complete job description and instructions on how to apply, visit kbu.fm/employment. Apply by February 24th. KBOO is an affirmative action and equal opportunity employer.
Welcome to Sprouts Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location each week.
It's a really incredible David and Goliath situation, where the majority of countries in the world work together to develop the first categorical prohibition on nuclear weapons.
I'm Spencer Graves with 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Today on Sprouts, we will discuss the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or TPNW, which entered into force January 22. On this show, Ann Sulentrop of PeaceWorks Kansas City interviews Ray Atchison, director of Reaching Critical Will, a project of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, or WILF, and Timon Wallace, executive director of nuclearban.us. A video and transcript of this broadcast are available in the Wikiversity article on Nuclear Weapons Treaty, Will It Save the World?
I'm Ann Sulentrop. The Ban Treaty actually is a local story, because the city of Kansas City, Missouri, actually, believe it or not, owns title to one of the 8 major factories or sites in the U.S. that together make nuclear weapons for the United States. And so, since 1949, Kansas City has made or procured 85% of the non-radioactive parts for nuclear weapons. We make nuclear weapons work. Our plant makes the guidance systems, the arming and fusing, the metals, the foams, other materials that hold the radioactive parts that blow up, the plutonium, uranium, and the tritium. Tonight, we have two very distinguished, internationally known guests here to discuss this treaty. We have Ray Atchison. She's the director of Reaching Critical Will, the disarmament program of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Ray represents Wilf on the steering group of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN. This is a group that won the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize for its work to ban nuclear weapons. Ray has an honors BA in Peace and Conflict Studies from the University of Toronto and an MA in Politics from the New School for Social Research. She is currently a visiting research collaborator at Princeton University's Program on Science and Global Security. And she has a book coming out in June called Banning the Bomb, Smashing the Patriarchy, which I have ordered and I can't wait to read it. Timon Wallace, our other guest, has a BA in Human Ecology and a PhD in Peace Studies. He has written and campaigned extensively on peace and environmental issues over several decades. And his most recent publication in 2019 is a booklet, Warheads to Windmills, How to Pay for a Green New Deal. It is available on the website Nuclear Ban US. He is currently the executive director of Nuclear Ban US, a partner of ICANN. The Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons was adopted in 2017. We'll begin by asking Ms. Atchison for a little summary of the Ban Treaty and its history.
The treaty took about 10 years really to develop, and of course anti-nuclear organizing has been going on for a long time before that, since 1945, and diplomatic efforts at the United Nations have been going on for about that long as well. So it comes from a long history of opposition to nuclear weapons. But this specific treaty and the approach to develop it has been really unique because we've recognized that the nuclear armed states were refusing to comply with their legal obligations to disarm under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, that they're investing, in fact, billions of dollars into the modernization of their nuclear weapons and the nuclear weapon facilities and factories that produce these weapons. And really engaging in a new arms race. And, you know, we hear, of course, in the media about Russia's modernization or China's development of nuclear weapons or North Korea's, but also the United States is massively investing in a new generation of nuclear weapons and new capabilities for their missiles and bombers and things like that too. So this treaty was really an effort by the non-nuclear countries in the world working with activists in ICANN to do something despite the nuclear armed states and despite their objections to us making new international law. So it's a really incredible story of, you know, kind of the David and Goliath situation where you have the majority of countries in the world who've been very silenced on this issue for decades and told that, no, you don't have to worry about this issue. We've got it under control. You know, us big boys with the massive military hardware, we'll sort it out amongst ourselves and you just need to accept it, basically. And so countries finally said no to this, and we worked together to develop this treaty, which is the first categorical prohibition on nuclear weapons. It's kind of amazing to think about that. They're not banned the way that chemical weapons and biological weapons, other weapons of mass destruction, were banned. You know, even landmines and cluster bombs have been prohibited by international law, but nuclear weapons have escaped this for so long. So it puts nuclear weapons on the same footing as these other terrible, inhumane, indiscriminate weapons. And it also puts all countries on the same footing before the law so that we don't have this situation where the nuclear armed states, you know, get to say that they can retain their weapons, but others can't acquire them in that sort of discriminatory policy. It's comprehensive in what it prohibits. It prohibits all nuclear weapon related activities, so possession, development, use, threat of use, testing, deployment, everything to do with nuclear weapons. It also contains provisions for the elimination of nuclear weapons, because we believe that this treaty will compel the nuclear armed states to eliminate their arsenals over time. It also outlaws assistance with any of the prohibited activities I just mentioned. So this is really where the impact on the nuclear weapon complex in particular comes in. And we can already see the ways that this treaty is helping with our campaign for financial divestment from nuclear weapons. We've been getting for years now financial institutions like banks and pension funds to remove their money from nuclear weapon producers. And this is already happening all over the world and will only grow in impact once the treaty enters into force. And so even though the nuclear armed states don't support this treaty yet, and they've put so much pressure on other countries not to develop it and now not to join it, and they're objecting to its entry into force, and they say things like it will never affect customary international law and they'll never be bound by it, blah, 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 and all these things that, you know, I don't know, democratic states probably shouldn't say that they'll never change their positions on things. But this also really tells us that we're on the right track, right? Because they're scared. They're obviously scared of this treaty. They've put in a lot of effort to try and prevent it from coming into being. They know that it's going to have a stigmatizing effect on the possession of their weapons. They know it will be a change to international law and the implications that this will have on their behavior, on their policies. Nuclear weapons were already considered to be immoral by most people, but now they're also illegal. And while the treaty is only binding on the states that ratify it, international law has a normative effect. And we see this time and time again. We saw it with the bans on landmines and cluster bombs. These weapons aren't completely gone yet, but we're getting there. Their use is condemned. Most countries don't possess them anymore. Most countries don't produce them anymore, including the United States, which hasn't joined either treaty and yet doesn't produce them anymore. And is one of the biggest donors to landmine clearance in the world. So we can see the normative impact that international law has over time. Stigmatizing bad behavior works. We can see this in our personal lives. We can see it every day on the internet. Stigmatization is not something that has a transformative effect overnight in an immediate sense, but it changes over time. It's an iterative process. It's how all social movements work and how all social change progresses.
And could you tell us a little bit about your upcoming book? What kind of things does that talk about?
So it talks a lot about what I've just discussed. It covers the history of how we got to the point of wanting to develop a treaty that bans nuclear weapons, even if the nuclear armed states objected. And it kind of walks through the different attempts that had been made by other governments, by diplomats, by activists, what we had been trying for nearly 70 years to do to get them to disarm. It covers a feminist and an anti-racist critique of nuclear weapons and really situates these weapons as part of the discriminatory, racialized, capitalist system that promotes violence and that invests in violence over peace and cooperation and equality and justice. So it tries to tie it also into other movements that we see right now for abolition of structures of violence in the United States and around the world, other social movements throughout history that have really confronted power in a similar way. And then it offers a firsthand account of what this process looked like to ban nuclear weapons from my perspective, from a perspective of a feminist anti-war activist working within the activist side of things from the very beginning of the process, collaborating with diplomats, doing different actions around the world with other anti-nuclear movements, and really building up a sense of community to go ahead with this treaty, which we always knew was going to be a heavy lift for everyone involved. And it covers all of the obstacles and the pressure that we faced from the countries that were against us, And it goes through the negotiations as well and looks at why things are the way in the treaty, why things are the way they are in the treaty, you know, why we decided on particular language for things, and tries to really break it down and explain it to an audience that doesn't necessarily have a background in international law or nuclear weapons, but tries to make it more accessible and more interesting, I think, as a case study of how people can come together to change the world. You know, we're just a bunch of individuals. We're not fancy people. We're just doing this work and trying our best and getting things wrong and getting things right. And so it's sort of a story of that, of how we got to where we are now and where we hope to go from here.
We've been listening to Ann Sulentrop of Peace Works Kansas City interviewing Ray Atchison about the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons and her forthcoming book on banning the bomb, Smashing the Patriarchy. And next asks Timon Wallace about his booklet, Warheads to Windmills, How to Pay for a Green New Deal.
So Timon, Mr. Wallace, could you tell us a little bit about the ideas in your booklet, Warheads to Windmills? Because while we definitely want to abolish nuclear weapons, we're concerned about our 5,000 employees here in Kansas City that work in our nuclear weapons plant. We don't want to, you know, suddenly put them out of a job, but we're like one of our billboards says, we want to repurpose the plant. And we put a billboard out there on the highway leading to the plant.
Terrific. Yes. Well, thank you. I worked on this report. It's based on a report that was done in the UK a few years ago that looked very specifically at a similar plant where they make the Trident submarines in England, and what could be done with those workers to address another existential threat to the globe, you know, which is climate change. And the report in the UK went into a lot of detail about the actual job descriptions of people working in this submarine factory and all the things that were needed to build a tidal power, you know, electricity generation in that very part of England. So it wasn't just, you know, looking at the jobs that could be transferred, but people wouldn't even have to move house. You know, they need those people right there in the north of England working on green energy technologies and the same kinds of skills, you know, engineering skills and the same kind of scientific and technical skills for building a submarine were needed for building these new, you know, green energy projects. So I took that idea and wanted to know, you know, what we could do here in the US on the same kind of lines. I mean, obviously there's a much bigger industry here. Mm-hmm. So we looked at, first of all, you know, what do we actually need to build a green economy? You know, we need to build lots more windmills and solar panels, and we need to get electric cars going and train, you know, high-speed rail, and all those kind of things. But we also need to develop a lot more technological solutions that we don't have yet on, you know, making batteries more efficient and effective, on, you know, how to get air travel electrified or using other, you know, non-fossil fuel ways. But also, you know, not that many, I mean, I didn't know about these things before, but, you know, the production of cement, the production of steel, you know, there's a lot of industrial processes that we use for all kinds of other things that rely on fossil fuels. And so, you know, we need to be doing research, we need to be doing engineering projects to figure out how to solve these problems. And it's not just a matter of like finding jobs for people who are going to be out of work when we get rid of nuclear weapons. We actually need these people. We need them urgently to work on these projects. Because, you know, as we know, we're you know, after tomorrow, we've got a lot of catching up to do from the last 4 years of, you know, undermining the whole progress towards addressing the climate crisis. But there's urgency to this, and there's real need for, you know, using our best scientists and engineers and technicians and put them to work on really addressing the problems that we face as a society, not instead of just making weapons of mass destruction. You know, we need those people. So it's, you know, there's of course the money involved and the amount of, you know, I mean, Ray talked about the billions of dollars going into the nuclear weapons, you know, developments, all these new systems that are underway right now. I mean, over the next 30 years, the U.S. government's already committed trillions, literally, towards a whole new generation of nuclear weapons. And instead of doing that, we need that money, we need that brain power and the workers to actually be addressing something like the climate crisis, and as well as many other urgent, pressing social needs that are out there. And the other piece of it, which we looked at, is it just so happens that the countries that are pointing nuclear weapons at each other are also the countries that are spewing out the most carbon into the atmosphere. And unless we find ways of working together more cooperatively, we're not going to solve the climate crisis. You know, we need to stop the whole idea that we're only safe if we point nuclear weapons and threaten to destroy other whole countries. And once we get beyond that and start looking at how we can work together and collaborate more, we can solve all these other problems. So that's what we were trying to do in that report.
Brilliant. And I was fascinated the other day on a webinar where you talked about how the multinational corporations that currently make nuclear weapons around the world, I think you said there was 36 of them, how they will be impacted by this treaty in a very real, concrete way. And you specifically talked, what really caught my attention was Honeywell, which manages our plant. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, Honeywell claims to have operations in 110 countries. So if you look at which countries they're operating in, you will find straight away a number of them have already signed and ratified the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, like Mexico, New Zealand, Malaysia, Thailand, and there's many others that are on their way to ratifying the treaty that will have further impact, Indonesia, Philippines, Brazil, and so on. So a country like Honeywell, I mean, a company like Honeywell, operating in these countries that, as of this Friday, are making everything to do with nuclear weapons illegal in those countries. You know, we don't know yet what kind of restrictions they may face, what kind of penalties they may face, but certainly there's a precedent. Ray was talking about these other treaties, like the Landmines Treaty and the Cluster Munitions Treaties. Those both use the exact same language about prohibition of assisting with any of these companies making these prohibited weapons. And for many of those countries, they've included investment as explicitly prohibited, not just in some cases prohibition for the country to have investments in the companies, but prohibition for anybody to have investments in those companies. We're going to be working very hard to encourage those countries to really, you know, take as strong a stand as they're willing to on this issue of assistance, because as Ray was saying, you know, there's already a very strong movement to divest from the nuclear weapons industry. Two of the five largest pension funds in the world have already made that commitment. Other banks and financial institutions, we're just getting started in this country, but we've already got some very exciting entities that have divested. And as you may have heard, New York City has a majority on the New York City Council ready to divest the New York City Pension Fund, which will be very exciting. We have a bill in the Massachusetts State House for divestment of pension funds in Massachusetts. There's other movements going on all around the country. So divestment is definitely an issue, but also contracts. These companies, I mean, we started out with a campaign to boycott Honeywell thermostats, because, you know, I've got one right here in the room that I'm in right now. They're everywhere, you know. And this was one of the campaigns in the 1980s that got General Electric and other companies to pull out of the nuclear weapons industry, because they were people start, you know, there was a campaign to boycott General Electric light bulbs. And Honeywell, I mean, not Honeywell, but Morton Tycol salts, you know, made table salts. There were these campaigns that, you know, everybody, you know, buys salt and has light bulbs, and everybody has a thermostat, or many people do. But then after the first couple of years of our campaign, we wrote thousands of letters to the CEO of Honeywell, Darius Adamczyk. And we went to the Honeywell shareholders meeting. You know, we've done all kinds of things. And they, in 2019, I think it was, they sold their thermostat division, which was clever on their part. It was annoying for us because, you know, they don't make thermostats anymore. They've sold it. But they do make other things. And the big thing that these companies are involved in, not so much consumer products like that, but big infrastructure projects and IT projects that they do with cities and states and large institutions. They have, a lot of them make medical equipment. Honeywell makes equipment for hospitals, and we've working with our local hospital, which is part of a consortium of 20 hospitals in Massachusetts, to say, you know, we don't want to buy any medical equipment from these companies. Doctors are very much on board with the anti-nuclear message, and so we're quite confident that we can start getting that message out there. We had our town, Northampton in Massachusetts, recently. They voted to refuse contracts with any of these companies for a city contract, like, you know, buying radios for the police department or whatever. Now, that was not allowed by Massachusetts state law, because they control, you know, what kind of criteria you can use to choose a contract. So we had to go to the state of Massachusetts. It took us 18 months. They passed a bill in the state house. It was signed by the governor, and now we have the right to refuse contracts with those companies. And now every other town in Massachusetts is trying to do the same thing. Kansas City should have a go at it. I mean, you know, there's things happening all around the country in this, you know, to try to raise this issue and put the pressure on the companies, because those companies, it's not just that they're directly making these weapons, those companies are pouring millions into trying to control how the Congress and the president makes these decisions and how they vote on these things. They put money into their re-election campaigns, they put all the money into lobbying, and they hire these people for their boards or for special consultancies and so on. And these companies need to be held to account. They need to be, they need to feel that people are caring about this issue and they're really going to do something about it. And it's not, as we said at the beginning, it's not just to punish these companies or the workers, because we want them to be doing, you know, life-affirming work instead of death work. You know, we want them to be
exactly
building things that we need, right, for for addressing other issues.
Yes. And just to wrap up, Ray, could you tell us a little bit about the positive obligations of the treaty for assisting victims and, remediation of environments?
Yeah, this is the first nuclear weapon-related treaty that includes positive obligations. And it's building off of, again, the landmine and cluster bomb treaties. And it's considered part of this growing landscape for what we call humanitarian disarmament, which is putting people first, people and planet first, in the way that we think about weapons and conflict and war. And so the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons includes provisions for assistance to victims of nuclear weapon use and testing, and also for environmental remediation. Now, we understand, of course, that this type of cleanup environmental remediation is a very difficult long-term project, and that there is many complex issues around assistance to victims as well. But the point of them being in the treaty is really to highlight and remind states of their human rights obligations to their citizens and to the citizens of other countries where they may have used or tested these weapons, because there's a long legacy of the nuclear armed states testing these weapons, not on their own soil, but on the soil of other countries or on the soil of indigenous lands at home. And so this is really important for highlighting those concerns and bringing help to those communities.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Ann Sulentrop of Peaceworks Kansas City, interviewing Ray Atchison, director of Reaching Critical Will, a project of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and Timon Wallace, executive director of NuclearBan.us, discussing the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or TPNW, which entered into force January 22. Nuclear weapons are now officially illegal in the 52 parties to that treaty. Supporters believe that it will ultimately lead to the elimination of nuclear weapons, similar to the impact of the treaties banning landmines and cluster bombs. Atchison is author of a forthcoming book, Banning the Bomb, Smashing the Patriarchy. Wallace is author of Warheads to Windmills, How to Pay for a Green New Deal. A video with a transcript of this broadcast is available in the Wikiversity article on Nuclear Weapons Treaty, Will It Save the World? That's Wikiversity, not Wikipedia, on Nuclear Weapons Treaty, Will It Save the World? Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Brian David at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you would like to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Spencer Graves with KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Thanks for listening. See you next week on Sprouts.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open